KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. A California woman and her brother prepared to evacuate but decided first to hose down the fire in their backyard. We have glimpses of the LA wildfires in this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. We speak with the councilwoman who represents one of the neighborhoods that have been engulfed in flames, Pacific Palisades. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The fire reached the Getty Villa Museum, but not its collection. We'll hear from the Getty Trust's leader. Also, we placed a call to Plains, Georgia, and we have a conversation with Kim Carter Fuller, niece of former President Jimmy Carter, whose funeral is today. It's Thursday, January 9th. 7 years ago today, mudslides struck California hillsides that had been stripped of vegetation by wildfire. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The memorial service for former President Jimmy Carter is underway at the Washington National Cathedral. The state funeral is being held for Carter, who died last week at the age of 100. His grandson, Joshua Carter, eulogized him.
My grandfather spent the entire time I've known him helping those in need. He built houses for people that needed homes. He eliminated diseases in forgotten places. He waged peace anywhere in the world, wherever he saw a chance. He loved people.
All five living presidents are in attendance at the cathedral service, former Presidents Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama. President-elect Trump is there. President Biden will deliver another eulogy. This is a national day of mourning for Carter. That means all federal government offices are closed. There won't be any regular U.S. Postal Service deliveries, and the U.S. stock markets are closed, a tradition dating back to the assassination of former President Abraham Lincoln. Three major wildfires are still burning out of control in the Los Angeles area. They've killed at least five people and destroyed about 2,000 structures. The wildfires have been driven by powerful winds this week, but CAL FIRE Battalion Chief Brent Pasqua says the difference in wind conditions this morning is like night and day.
We have some calm winds actually right now, which is a very welcoming sight to see out here. I believe if it stays like this, we can actually turn a corner on these fires and make some progress today, some good progress.
He spoke to NBC's Today Show. Authorities have ordered 130,000 people to evacuate. NPR's Kirk Siegler was in the Pacific Coast community of Santa Monica as people fled the fast-moving Palisades fire.
Evacuation orders are in place for this area. Please leave immediately.
Lisa France had her bags packed, and when an alert came on her cell phone, she got ready to leave as fast as she could.
You know, I'm scared because
She's on crutches after a surgery and was struggling down the stairs of her 70-year-old apartment building. She says she's not taking any chances.
I've seen what they do. You know, there's just not enough resources, and they just can't fight everything. So if it catches here, if something, an ember or something catches here, that's it.
France, who doesn't have renter's insurance, says she's grateful to have found a motel room for at least one night by the 405 freeway for under $300. Kirk Siegler, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Forecasters say a powerful winter storm is settling over much of the southern U.S. There are winter warnings, watches, and advisories stretching from New Mexico to the Carolinas. Quite a lot of snow is expected in northern Texas, Oklahoma, parts of Arkansas, and Louisiana. Areas that could get ice include Tennessee and Kentucky. It's NPR. Lebanon's parliament has chosen a new president for the country. It's Lebanese army commander Joseph Aoun. Lebanon has been without a president for more than 2 years because of political deadlock. The country is also facing several crises. These include Israel's attacks on the militant group Hezbollah, based in Lebanon, and the country's dire economic situation. Pope Francis has intensified his criticism of Israel's military campaign in Gaza. He's calling the humanitarian situation, quote, shameful. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports from Rome.
In his yearly gathering with diplomats, Pope Francis asked an aide to read his speech because he's recovering from a cold. The address focused on the Pope's hopes that this will be the year that sees an end to the wars in Ukraine and in Gaza. He called the humanitarian situation in Gaza very serious and shameful, and elsewhere in his speech he wrote, "We cannot accept that children are freezing to death or the bombing of civilians." Every night the Pope speaks by phone with parishioners in Gaza. In recent months, Pope Francis has been more outspoken about Israel's military campaign against Hamas there and said jurists and international experts should investigate whether Israel's actions in Gaza constitute genocide. The Israeli government responded angrily, saying the pontiff had ignored the wider context of the war and Israel's security concerns. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
The U.S. government says it will still consider grizzly bears in the Rocky Mountains a threatened species. Some Western state officials say they consider grizzlies to be recovering in numbers. Grizzlies will still remain largely protected. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Coming up, President-elect Trump is pressing Republican senators to pass his policy priorities and says he doesn't much mind just how.
First, though, we have an update on the fires burning through the Los Angeles area. Today, every school in Los Angeles is closed. It's one way that wildfires have affected the nation's second largest city.
The fires have sometimes destroyed whole neighborhoods. They wrecked the homes of celebrities. Billy Crystal says he lost the house where he's lived with his wife since 1979. Several people are dead that we know of so far, and new fires appear as desert winds blow embers around the region.
We're joined now by NPR's Adrian Florido in Los Angeles. Good morning, Adrian.
Good morning, Michelle.
Could you just give us an overview of the kind of destruction that these fires are causing?
Well, a lot of the destruction so far is from the Pacific Palisades fire, which is where one of the two biggest fires is burning. News choppers were able to fly over that affluent coastal community yesterday and filmed block after block of homes reduced to ash. Homes in nearby Malibu also burned. The Hollywood Hills caught fire last night, and that blaze has quickly spread, forcing chaotic evacuations there. I was able yesterday to get into a neighborhood ravaged by the other big fire, the Eaton Fire, in Altadena on the east side of Los Angeles. I walked past more than 20 homes burning or already burned to the ground, and that was over just a couple of blocks.
I mean, it just sounds like a horrific scene there. Would you just describe more about what you saw?
You know, well, the ruins of many of the houses in the neighborhood where I was were still burning, and every so often something under the rubble would explode or a wooden door frame would finish collapsing, and it would shoot up this puff of embers. And it was windy, so neighbors were rushing to make sure that those embers didn't set their houses on fire. I met Brittany Mann as she and her brother were hosing down their roof and their lawns before evacuating.
The street behind us are what caught fire, so our backyard caught fire. So we're still trying to get those fires out. before we leave.
And across the street, Michelle, I met Sarah Rudd. She evacuated on Tuesday night, but while she was gone, her neighbor, who had not evacuated, noticed that her house had caught fire, and she said that he grabbed his hose.
Some of our neighbors who stayed back when they shouldn't have, they actually saved a lot of homes. Like our house right here, you can see where it's charred on the side, and he saved our house.
When we spoke, she had just come back to check on her house. She was leaving it again. But as we spoke, other houses were burning on her block. So hers was still at risk, and there were no firefighters around.
Adrian, to that point, we've been hearing about how there just don't seem to be enough resources to fight all these fires. What can you tell us about that?
Well, fire officials have said LA just doesn't have enough firefighters to tackle so many large fires at once. The ones who have been out there since Tuesday are exhausted. LA's mayor, Karen Bass, says that more crews are coming in from other counties and cities. Officials also said that some of the fire hydrants that firefighters were tapping into in the Pacific Palisades went dry on Tuesday. Winds that day had prevented aircraft from doing water drops, so hydrants were the only option, and they couldn't take the strain. Janice Quinones is LA's top water official.
You're fighting a wildfire with a fire hydrant system. Fire hydrants are not made to fight multiple houses, hundreds of houses at a time.
She said that officials are still working to fill the tanks and the reservoirs where water is needed.
Adrian, do you have any sense of when these fires may be under control?
No, not really, Michelle. There are several major fires burning across the region. Conditions are extremely dry, and it's the winds spreading these flames and making this also unpredictable. High winds are expected at least through tonight, so this emergency is not over.
That is NPR's Adrian Florido in Los Angeles. Adrian, thank you.
Thanks, Michelle.
The Palisades fire has spread to the grounds of the Getty Villa. The museum holds more than 44,000 antiquities from ancient Greece and Rome. Trees and vegetation on the property have burned, but the museum's structures and its collection are safe and intact. That's according to our next guest, Catherine Fleming. She is the president and CEO of the J. Paul Getty Trust, which operates the museum. Thank you so much for joining us, Ms. Fleming.
Good morning. Good morning, Michelle.
Can you just tell us a little bit more about what is happening around the villa this morning?
Well, what is happening around the villa is still an active fire zone. As you've just heard, there are very strong and unpredictable winds, largely offshore winds today, that are making this an ongoing crisis. The Palisades fire, within which the Getty Villa is found, has grown over the course of the night, moved further north and further east. But at the Getty Villa itself, all of the stuff on the ground that was going to burn has burned. And thankfully, because we had been planning for an event of this sort, but certainly not of these proportions, we'd been planning for a long time, a lot of the brush had already been cleared out over the course of the past year before the fire arrived. So at the villa itself, we have staff, we have great staff on site keeping an eye out, but things have largely calmed down for us there.
Well, that's good to hear. Can you just say more about what kind of planning went into this and protecting the museum structures and the items in the collection? And I also, of course, do want to know how you're keeping the staff safe.
The staff obviously are the number one priority. The Getty, for anyone who knows it, has a super strong culture of safety. It's really safety obsessed, and also is acutely aware of the fact that it's a repository for global cultural heritage that we hold sort of on behalf of the world. So we are constantly, in all sorts of ways, not just in terms of fires, running all kinds of exercises to make sure that we have systems in place to protect people and to protect the collection. In the case of fires, what we have done is just constant and really extensive brush clearance around all of our buildings, done all sorts of improvements. We do what's called fuel reduction. So you prune and you thin the trees. You do everything you can to lift, raise the tree canopies up from the ground. None of it's sexy, but it's all super important at a moment like this. You thin out low-level plant materials to reduce the mass. And that really helps to reduce the fire load and, takes a lot of the velocity out of the fire as it comes through. Go ahead.
I was going to say that, the Getty Center in Brentwood temporarily closed in 2017 and 2019 due to fires burning nearby. Did you learn some lessons from that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think all of us together are learning that urban centers are not immune from this, especially in a geography like Los Angeles's, where the urban center includes forest, it includes open land, and it includes very, very dry mountainsides. So yes, absolutely. Next time you're up at the center, mm-hmm. you can look around and you'll see there are no plants anywhere really near the buildings. That's precisely because of this.
It's like the very things that make it such a gorgeous area to live in are the very things that make it so dangerous right now. Do you have any evacuation plans in place for any particular items?
No, we would not be evacuating items. We have designed our sites to make sure that items would probably the safest place for the items to be in an event like this, wild as it sounds, is to be at one of our sites. It would be a pretty bad move to try and evacuate anything during an event of this sort. You know, up at the villa itself, the buildings are of super high rated fire resistive construction. We've got double walled structures. There's really, really significant protection for the galleries kind of hardwired into the design of the buildings.
So that's good to hear. Before we let you go, do you mind if I ask, how are you doing?
I'm okay. I'm way, way more okay than lots and lots of people in this city are. I have a home, thank God. And where I am at the base of the hill of the Getty Center, it smells like smoke, but I can breathe pretty easily. So really, our number one concern right now is for all of the people who aren't doing anywhere near as well as I am. But thank you for asking.
That is Catherine Fleming. She's president and CEO of the J. Paul Getty Trust. Thank you so much for talking to us. And we're going to keep a good thought for you and for everybody else who's affected by this. And of course, for the collection.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
The stock markets are closed today, joining a national day of mourning for former President Jimmy Carter. NPR financial correspondent Maria Aspen reports on a tradition that goes back almost 160 years.
The New York Stock Exchange usually begins the day like this. But today, as the nation officially mourns former President Jimmy Carter, Wall Street will be listening to another kind of bell. Those bells are from the funeral of former President George H.W. Bush in 2018. That's the last time the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ closed to honor a U.S. president. They're closing again today to mourn Carter. Tal Cohen is NASDAQ's president.
Collectively, we want to make the decision to honor former President Carter for his service during the time he was president, but again, more than that, all that he contributed to our country and, quite frankly, the globe after his presidency.
This tradition began in 1865 when President Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. The New York Stock Exchange shut for days. Since then, Wall Street has closed its doors several times.
We also did it for President Roosevelt, President Kennedy, President Nixon, President Reagan.
It's pretty rare for the stock market to close in the middle of the week. But it's also happened after national disasters, including the September 11th terrorist attacks and Hurricane Sandy. And not all financial markets are taking today off. Bond markets are staying open until 2 p.m. Cohen says that the NASDAQ had some time to prepare for today after Carter died in late December. His company made its plans with other exchanges, regulators, and other parts of the financial industry.
It did require a large undertaking, but we thought it was worth the effort, and we had the time. Given what we knew that day would be, we had the time to reflect and make sure that we could manage it appropriately.
The NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange will reopen on Friday morning. Maria Aspen, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, on the day of Jimmy Carter's funeral, we feature part two of our remembrance of Carter with excerpts of the interviews we recorded over the years. He talked about his poetry, his concerns about how intertwined politics and religion had become, a somber holiday season soon after 9/11, and we have an interview with Carter and his daughter Amy. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures Classics with The Room Next Door, starring Julianne Moore and Tilda Swinton. Years later, two friends meet again in an extreme situation. Directed by Pedro Almodovar, now playing select cities only in theaters. From the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Jimmy Carter goes home today after a funeral here in Washington, which we will cover live on NPR. The former president's family takes his remains to a private service in his hometown. Almost 2 years ago, when the former president first went into hospice care, we placed a call to that hometown and reached Kim Carter Fuller.
I'm in Plains, Georgia. I'm looking out the window at downtown Plains.
She is Jimmy Carter's niece, the daughter of his brother, Billy. She's lived her whole life in Plains.
Downtown area is one main street, one block, basically. And my office is on that block.
Well, good. That's great. You're at the center of the action then, I suppose.
Yes, I am.
Her uncle Jimmy grew up nearby, went away to the Navy, and returned, built a house, the house that he and First Lady Rosalynn Carter called home right to the end. Carter ran for the state legislature and then won election as governor and then the presidency. Fuller was in college when he won the national election in 1976.
When he won the presidency that night, Plains was swamped. And this was before, you know, good internet and all that kind of stuff. They were broadcasting on the sides of buildings downtown.
This next couple of months, I'll be doing the best I can to prepare myself to be a president, of which all of you will be proud. And I believe that I can make the kind of leadership in the White House that can tap the greatness that's in all of you.
I'm just thinking about the power of that moment. This is someone being elected president and the first president from the South since before the Civil War. That must have been quite a moment to live through.
It was. It was. I'm getting chill bumps just thinking about it. It was the type of moment that I think most of us, and I know me in particular, we kind of thought, well, this might never happen again. Same thing when he won the Nobel Peace Prize. You know, we had a celebration down here, downtown, right outside where I am now, and we were able to celebrate with him.
Do you recall what it was like when you saw him in the first months or years after his defeat?
Yeah, he was very sad. My dad owned a service station here in town, and after my husband and I got married, my husband ran it. And I will never, ever forget the night that Uncle Jimmy was coming home, or the afternoon after he lost. And leaving the White House. And the phone rang in the station, and Daddy answered it. It was a phone on the wall. And I will always remember him saying, just come home. We're waiting for you. Just come home. And it was pouring down rain here. And the streets were just thronged with people, just like they were the night that he won. People were here to welcome him back home. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, have asked, well, why did they move back to Plains? Why did they do that? Well, that's one reason they did. Because they knew if they had to go somewhere, it was time to come home.
Mm. What do you think kept him going all those years? Traveling the world, getting involved in elections, getting involved in peace negotiations, building houses for Habitat for Humanity, writing book after book after book. Where do you think that energy came from?
I think one thing that motivated him was the fact that he, deep in his heart, I think he knew what people needed. And he just had such a strong sense of, I think, morality, compassion. He's a servant leader. And that servanthood just, he couldn't keep it closed off. He had to share it.
If you were asked to sum him up in a few sentences, what would you say?
Uncle Jimmy is a man who doesn't just talk about how he feels about his place in the world. He walks that talk. I've never known him to have empty words, so to speak. I've always known him to be a person who does what he feels is right. He is a deeply caring man, and he shows that care to not only his family, but to the people around him. I just wish I had 1/10 of what he has inside of him.
Kim Carter Fuller is executive director of Friends of Jimmy Carter and a niece of the late president. We spoke in 2023. We'll have special coverage of Carter's state funeral this morning. You can listen live on the NPR app or on many local stations.
Here is a heads up to Girl Scout cookie fans. Two cookie flavors will be discontinued after this year. But do not fret, your Thin Mints are safe. NPR's Nita Ulibi has more.
You are forgiven if you've never heard of the two cookies that got laid off. One is called Toast Yays. It's based on the cinnamon mapleiness of French toast and came out in 2021. The other is Girl Scout S'mores, evoking the classic campfire treat.
What is the cream in there? Is that toothpaste?
The s'mores were roasted last year in Dustin Nickerson's podcast called Don't Make Me Come Back There. The comedian and his sidekicks compared the Girl Scout s'mores cream filling to that stuff between your tiles, caulk.
Yeah, that tastes like an adhesive. That is not good.
The Girl Scout s'mores debuted in 2017. They're among dozens of cookies that have been added and discontinued since Girl Scouts first started selling them to raise money more than 100 years ago. Remember Scott Tees or Savannah Smiles? Wendy Liu is Chief Revenue Officer for Girl Scouts of the USA. She's in charge of the cookie program.
So we do review our lineup on a regular basis. We definitely want to make sure we're maximizing the sales opportunity for our girls.
Around 700,000 Girl Scouts around the country sell about 200 million boxes of cookies each year, Lou says. And how much does that make for the Girl Scouts of the USA?
Roughly about $1 billion in revenue for the organization.
That means at least some Toast Yays and Girl Scout S'mores helped local Girl Scouts to camp, craft, volunteer, and to live by the Girl Scout law. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It has not been a quiet 4 years for Bill Burns as director of the CIA.
I've taken 84 trips overseas during that time, covered more than 1 million miles, and, you know, it's just deepened the pride that I have in the work of this agency.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. I sit down with Burns on his way out to ask about Russia, Iran, ISIS, and more. That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The National Cathedral is hosting the state funeral for former President Jimmy Carter. He died late last month at the age of 100. Dignitaries from around the world stood hand to heart as Carter's flag-draped casket was carried into the cathedral, Carter's grandson Joshua spoke first.
My grandfather spent the entire time I've known him helping those in need. He built houses for people that needed homes. He eliminated diseases in forgotten places. He waged peace anywhere in the world, wherever he saw a chance. He loved people.
The state funeral has brought five presidents together under the same roof. President Biden, who is set to deliver the eulogy, and former presidents Barack Obama, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and Donald Trump, who is set to return to office on the 20th. Vice President Kamala Harris and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, both of whom unsuccessfully ran against Trump, are also seated nearby. Ahead of the service, Obama was seen interacting and occasionally laughing with Trump, next to whom he is seated. Former First Lady Michelle Obama is not in attendance, reportedly due to a scheduling conflict. Again, the state funeral for former President Jimmy Carter underway at the National Cathedral. It's NPR. Five deaths are now linked to the wildfires raging in Southern California. About 130,000 people are under evacuation orders. The fires have also caused power outages across the state. Australia says it is ready to help. Christina Kukulia reports Prime Minister Anthony Albanese extended the offer even as his own country faces the peak of its fire season.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says the Australian people are, quote, always available to help our American friends. Albanese described the scenes of wildfires in California as devastating and said the significant loss of life is tragic. He says he expressed Australia's support at a difficult time in the message to President Joe Biden. Meanwhile, Chris Minns, the Premier of New South Wales, one of the states that has previously sent firefighting crews to the United States, said any requests for assistance would be assessed. For NPR News, I'm Christina Kukulia in Melbourne, Australia.
A new report on notorious markets warns most online pharmacies are not legit. The U.S. Trade Representative's annual report finds nearly all of the world's 35,000 online pharmacies, many of which are based in China or other parts of Asia, are being run illegally. Customers run a much higher risk of being shipped potentially harmful counterfeit drugs. U.S. stocks are mixed, with the Dow up more than 100 points. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. By now, you've probably seen the pictures and heard the stories from the areas in and around Los Angeles that are engulfed in flames fueled by desert winds. At least five people have died. The Palisades Fire is the largest of five wildfires spread through the area. It has already burned through more than 17,000 acres. The state agency CAL FIRE says it is the most destructive blaze in California's history in the month of January. Throughout the morning, we've been checking in with individuals and officials in the area. Councilwoman Tracy Park is with us now. She represents the Pacific Palisades neighborhood where the fire is raging. Hello. How are you doing?
It's been a pretty horrible 48 hours, truthfully.
Tell me what you're seeing. I know you and your team have all been out, you know, in the area, you know, on the ground throughout this. Tell me just some of the things that you have seen.
Well, as the fire broke out on Tuesday, I was out at the command post at Will Rogers State Beach, and it looked like a volcano had erupted. There was just fire raging through the town and down the hillside. And, of course, the firefighting operations were impacted by 80 and 100-mile-an-hour gusts of wind, which prevented the ability to get assets into the air to fight the fire. There were chaotic evacuations and traffic backlogs. It was an absolutely terrifying situation on the ground. Overnight, the fire continued to grow, and as I was able to return to Palisades yesterday after the sun came up to get a first look at the scope and scale of the devastation, the scenes were absolutely apocalyptic. Mm. Most of the Palisades is gone.
It's devastating. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of time after this to talk about what went wrong and what could have been or done differently. But for right now, the thing that seems most immediate is that some of the fire hydrants that firefighters were tapping into ran dry yesterday. Do you know why that is?
So I had heard anecdotally during the course of the fire that there were issues with the water, but it wasn't until DWP announced it during the press conference yesterday that we learned that the demand on services was four times the normal load, and that impacted the ability of our firefighters to have enough water pressure to actually fight the fire. And unfortunately, you know, fighting a wildfire with a fire engine and a fire hydrant, that's not how you do it. You know, that's normally, it would be an air assault on the fire. And because they weren't able to do that, they had no other alternative but to try to put it out by ground with the hydrant. And that is something that, you know, we learned about yesterday. It, I think, raises more questions than answers, and it's, to me, feels indicative of what has been chronic underinvestment in the city of Los Angeles in critical infrastructure, as well as our public safety resources. This particular area is in the very high fire severity zone. Many mm-hmm. of these risks and threats are well known to the community. And so there is a lot of concern about this amongst residents who unfortunately have now lost everything.
That is Los Angeles Councilwoman Tracy Park. Councilwoman, thank you so much for joining us. We will all keep a good thought for you and for all the people that you're trying to take care of right now.
Thank you. Stay safe.
A federal appeals court may issue a ruling today that could help bring an end to the 9/11 terrorism case at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. This case has dragged on for more than two decades without going to trial. It involves the alleged mastermind of the attacks, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. It's part of a legal fight that has pitted Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin against the U.S. military court that he oversees. NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer has been covering this story for many years now and is back with us to explain all this. Good morning, Sasha.
Good morning, Michelle.
So tell us about this ruling that you're on the lookout for.
This deals with whether Mohammed will be allowed to get a plea deal. He and three co-defendants have agreed to plead guilty in exchange for up to life in prison. They would admit guilt in the deaths of nearly 3,000 people, and there would be no trial and no death penalty. But at the request of the Pentagon this week, the Justice Department asked a federal appeals court for two things. One, block the guilty pleas. To at least delay a hearing that's supposed to happen Friday so the court could have more time to decide whether to block those pleas. And those are the rulings that could come today.
Okay, but back up here. If these men have already agreed to plead guilty, why is there a debate over whether they are allowed to?
This is an ongoing legal saga that started when the plea deals were announced last summer by the military court. The deals were huge news because the 9/11 case is so gridlocked, and this was a way to end the gridlock. But 48 hours later, Secretary Austin took those plea deals off the table.
And why did he do that?
So as remarkable as this sounds, considering that, as you said, he oversees the military commissions, he said he had not known about the plea deals. Since then, two military courts, including an appeals panel, have ruled pretty decisively that Austin is not allowed to rescind the plea deals, so the guilty pleas can go forward. The legal debate should have been over at that point, according to a former military commissions lawyer I spoke with named Ian Moss, who's now in private practice. And Moss says by not accepting the plea deals, the government is squandering a chance to end a case that does not seem to have an end in sight otherwise.
This is essentially snatching victory from the jaws of self-defeat. After so long with no to minimal progress, there's finally an opportunity to have a resolution and closure.
And Michelle, Secretary Austin's own prosecutors have said plea deals are the best resolution.
So is there a precedent for DOJ getting involved in Guantanamo cases like this?
When it comes to defense lawyers for Guantanamo detainees, they have often gone to federal court to ask for some kind of relief, although they're usually denied. But Georgetown University law professor Steve Vladek tracks Guantanamo and told me that this scenario, where the prosecution side has already lost twice and is now asking a federal court to order a military judge to block the guilty pleas, is rare.
To call it unusual is a vast understatement. I mean, we've had the military commissions in some way, shape, or form now for over 20 years, and we haven't had a case like this before.
So if there is a ruling today, Sasha, what happens next?
Somebody is going to be unhappy no matter who rules, the losing side. And that losing side will probably take this to the Supreme Court. That's the next legal step after federal appeals. That could drag out the process for many more months, probably even years, because if Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is not allowed to plead guilty under a Biden administration, he almost certainly will not be allowed under a Trump administration.
And briefly, Sasha, what about the 9/11 family members?
Oh, they're so frustrated, so tired, so disillusioned, but all they can do for now is wait and watch.
That is NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer. Sasha, thank you.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
The state funeral of the late President Jimmy Carter will bring you the latest from Washington's National Cathedral next time in Here and Now.
With everything from groceries to orthodontics, yes, really, available on demand, why not public radio? Make playing NPR or this station part of your smart speaker routine to stay informed on your schedule.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. One thing you learn as a reporter is to call people on the phone, which is harder than for past generations. Surveys show young people resist making phone calls. So a UK college wants to help students get over telephobia. Nottingham College students practice doing job interviews by phone or calling restaurants to see if they're open. Now they just have to hope that somebody is willing to pick up the phone on the other end. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. President-elect Trump plans changes throughout the federal government. He's staffing his administration with aides who consider it wrong that Congress gave some federal agencies a measure of independence from the president. And that raises questions about what happens to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Congress established the CFPB after the Great Recession to write and enforce rules for the financial industry. In President Trump's first term, the CFPB ensured millions of dollars reached consumers who'd been misled by financial institutions. This very week, the agency under President Biden announced medical debt will not affect credit scores anymore. Christine Chen Zinner is a senior policy counsel at Americans for Financial Reform, a nonpartisan group that advocates for stricter regulation of Wall Street. She spoke with A. Martinez about what else the agency has done.
Last month, the CFPB finalized a rule to lower these incredibly outrageous overdraft fees from around $35 per overdraft fee down to $5 per overage. Earlier, they slashed credit card late fees that were as high as $41 down to $8 per late fee. Unfortunately, while the Biden-appointed regulators have generally been pretty aggressive on behalf of consumers, Wall Street and its allies have really exploited Trump's transformation of the judiciary. Particularly, we've noticed in the Fifth Circuit, which includes courts in Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. And quite a few consumer protection regulations were immediately challenged. There was also an effort to target discriminatory lending. That was also challenged in the Fifth Circuit. And then in December, within hours of the overdraft fee rule to reduce overdraft fees, financial institutions immediately challenged the rule in Mississippi.
Looking back, Christine, on Trump's first term, what specific things did he do to try and ding this organization?
Trump's first term was about driving Wall Street's lobby priorities and agenda, not really about protecting consumers. One of the things that happened was Director Kathy Craninger gutted crucial rules that were set to protect consumers from predatory payday and car title loans. And without these kind of guardrails, borrowers can be trapped into a cycle of never-ending debt. Director Craninger also relaxed financial institution reporting requirements. She also eased mortgage disclosure rules and rules around credit card disclosures. And the CFPB at the time waived rules on prepaid cards that were supposed to speed pandemic relief, but which people were later nickel and dimed with lots of junk fees just to access their payments or check balances.
So a new administration is almost upon us. What might change with this new administration? And also wondering, too, considering how close Elon Musk is to Donald Trump's ear, how that might change things.
Despite lots of attempts to dismantle this agency, the structure of the CFPB can come through a Trump administration intact, as it has before. This means having a single director with a secure funding stream, and this was validated by the Roberts Supreme Court. It would really require big bipartisan votes in the Senate to change that. That said, the overall atmosphere right now isn't great, with Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy hating on the CFPB and tweeting. And there's nothing stopping Trump and the Republican Party from installing a director who just wants to tear the agency down from the inside. However, I will say Trump ran as a populist. At one point, he even proposed capping credit card interest rates. So I think the Trump administration really has a decision to make about whether any of the populist rhetoric that came out of their campaign is meaningful or just a cover to let Wall Street take control of the CFPB.
Christine Chen Zinner is senior policy counsel at Americans for Financial Reform, a nonpartisan coalition focused on financial accountability. Christine, thanks.
Thank you so much, Jay. It was great chatting.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The Biden administration says a record 24 million people have enrolled in health plans from Affordable Care Act marketplaces. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin reports that could change when President-elect Trump takes office.
If you've heard this before, record enrollment in healthcare.gov and the state marketplaces, that's because there was just a record set last year and the year before.
This year, I was actually expecting the enrollment growth to maybe plateau a bit.
That's Cynthia Cox of KFF, a nonpartisan health research organization. She says the past few years, there were clear reasons for those record numbers, like lower premiums and higher demand because of the COVID pandemic. Nothing big changed this year that would keep pumping up demand.
So I think it's really remarkable that it's continuing to reach new record highs.
This year's record, 24 million people, is a lot. When President Biden took office 4 years ago, it was only 12 million. And that increase has chipped away at the overall number of uninsured people in the U.S. Javier Becerra, Secretary of Health and Human Services, briefed reporters earlier this week.
Today, more than 300 million Americans have health coverage. That's a record number.
White House domestic policy advisor Neera Tanden told reporters on the call, these numbers show that Biden administration policies have worked.
We made the largest investment ever into outreach efforts that help people sign up for health insurance. We've also eliminated bureaucratic red tape. And crucially, we've lowered health insurance premiums.
Now the question is, will any of this last after President Trump takes office? Trump has kept open the possibility of repealing the 14-year-old Affordable Care Act. He said in the presidential debate that he had the concepts of a plan for replacing it. Republicans, who are set to take the majority in both houses of Congress, by and large oppose the ACA. They especially don't like the enhanced federal subsidies from the pandemic era. Many people can now get plans for $10 a month. Those subsidies will expire next December unless Congress extends them. Again, here's Cynthia Cox from KFF.
If I was placing a bet, I would feel much more comfortable betting that the enhanced subsidies will be allowed to expire at the end of this year.
Neither the Trump-Vance transition team nor House Speaker Mike Johnson's office responded to NPR's request for comment. Cox says the only way the ACA boom could continue is if a few Republicans join Democrats in voting to extend the subsidies. And that might happen because...
where you have seen the most growth in ACA signups and also where people are benefiting the most financially actually tends to be in red states.
The biggest growth has been in Texas. In the last 4 years, enrollment there has gone up more than 200%. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
Much of this country faces cold weather. It is 19 degrees here in Washington this morning, but at least most of us can turn up the heat. People in parts of Moldova have some trouble with that part. The former Soviet Republic is facing a winter heating crisis because they are a casualty of geopolitics. They were affected when a deal that allowed natural gas to move through pipelines from Russia to Europe collapsed. NPR's Charles Maines is covering this from Moscow. Hey there, Charles.
Morning.
Who's affected?
Well, you know, this crisis is really focused on a specific region of Moldova called Transnistria. It's a self-declared republic. It's not recognized internationally. That broke away from Moldova in the aftermath of the end of the Soviet Union. And it survived thanks to support from Moscow, not only in the form of Russian peacekeeping troops on the ground, but also cheap Russian gas. Now that that gas has been cut off, Transnistria has seen a cascade of problems. First, there was no heat and hot water, with residents told to gather firewood or head to warming stations. Then nearly all factories ground to a halt. And now it's important to keep in mind that Transnistria's key power plant has managed to switch to operating on coal. That's the good news. The bad is people have also switched to portable electric heaters. And that stressed the power grid to the limit, says the breakaway region's leader, Vadim Krasnoselsky. So here Krasnoselsky explains that Transnistrians are using a third more electricity than the power station can actually produce. And he warns that if that continues, the whole station will blow. There'll be no electricity at all.
Okay, this story teaches us something about infrastructure and about the way the economy works. So how did this gas crisis come about?
Well, the truth is Russia's gas trade with Europe, which goes back decades, unraveled amid the war in Ukraine, with most of Europe boycotting Russian exports in solidarity with Kyiv. There was, however, one notable exception until recently, a Russian pipeline that continued to run through Central Europe through, of all places, Ukraine.
Yeah.
And now the reason for this was that Ukraine had continued to honor a pre-invasion contract to export Russian gas to countries like Slovakia, Austria, and Moldova, with Kyiv collecting transit fees. Only that agreement formally ended January 1st, and Ukraine's government refused to extend it, saying it was akin to blood money.
Okay, so Ukraine takes another step in its conflict with Russia. They end the gas transit deal that a number of European countries depend upon. And how have different countries been dealing with it?
Well, you know, Ukraine gave some warning here. So even if not everybody's happy about it, most of Europe has come up with other energy solutions, including Moldova, frankly, which imported energy from the West, albeit at higher prices, which is no small ask for one of Europe's poorest countries. And yet Moldova remains vulnerable because of problems in this breakaway region, Transnistria, which never made the switch away from cheap Russian gas.
Well, what role is Russia playing here?
Well, the Kremlin spokesman this morning blamed Ukraine and Moldova for the crisis. However, Moldova argues there are these wider geopolitics at play. You know, gas exports have long been a tool of Russian influence in Moldova, but particularly at moments when Moldova's government has tried to move out of Russia's orbit. And that's exactly what's happening now, as the current government pursues membership in the European Union. The end of this Ukraine transit deal actually coincided with Russia suspending all gas exports to Moldova, supposedly over debts. It's a charge Moldova disputes. In fact, Moldova's Prime Minister, Adrian Rician, argues Russia's weaponizing the moment with an eye towards key elections in Moldova next fall.
The meaning of all of this is for Russia to create instability in the region, but also very importantly to influence the results of the parliamentary elections in Moldova.
Well, whether that's Russia's aim or not, and some observers argue you can't let Moldova's government off the hook entirely. They say if there's a humanitarian crisis in Transnistria, it's a challenge that Moldova needs to meet if it wants to smooth over resentments.
You taught me something about a strategic part of the world. NPR's Charles Maines, thanks so much.
Welcome, Steve.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Thank you.